Let's Go Green, sponsored by Airgrid, managing and operating Ireland's electricity grid for a cleaner energy future. Check out airgrid.ie for more.
Hello, and you are very welcome to this week's episode of Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. I'm your host, Aisling O'Rourke, and I hope you are safe and well as you tune into the show this week. As always, we have a packed lineup for you with lots, I think, of interesting conversations ahead. But first things first, have you ever considered heating your home with vegetable oil? Did you even know it was a possibility? And no, I'm not talking about, you know, the bottle of sunflower oil and sticking that down into the condensing boiler out the back in the back room. But we're talking about hydrogenated vegetable oil. And to talk more about this and the potential that HVO has, I'm joined by Kevin McPartlin of Fuels for Ireland. Kevin, you are very welcome to Let's Go Green.
Thanks very much, Aisling.
So first things first, I'm not one for jargon. I try to keep this program jargon free. What exactly is HVO when it's at home?
Well, you're in good company because I'm the least technical person that you'll probably have on the show. So essentially, HVO is an example of a lower carbon liquid fuel. So there are advanced synthetic and biofuels, and HVO is essentially a biofuel. Okay. So what that is most commonly, and most commonly in Ireland in particular, it's used cooking oil. So it's not quite the bottle that you might have in the press, but it may well be from the chipper that you get your unhealthy dinner from on a Friday evening coming home from work, that they very often have their oil collected, as do most of the fast food restaurants. And that then goes off and it goes into a refinery process, and it is refined very much along the same lines that crude oil is refined into a product that can be used in boilers. So that's what it is. It involves the use of hydrogen, as you say, hydro-treated vegetable oil. That's part of the process. So it is a refined product. It meets quality standards. We know that it is a very homogeneous product. It's not that it depends on what they were frying last Friday night in your particular chipper. It is always meets the very rigorous high standards. HVO is the one that's very current at the moment. It's been talked about a lot. Mm-hmm. It is the case that people in the Midlands may well be able to get it from their local fuel supplier and fill their tank, which otherwise would use kerosene to heat their home. It's also being provided at some forecourts. It can be a drop-in replacement for diesel. Most commonly, that's now being used by hauliers and by large companies. So most of Fuels for Ireland members, for example, use HVO to fuel their own fleets rather than using diesel. It eliminates about 90% of the emissions that you would mm-hmm. have from either kerosene or diesel. So kerosene, when you talk about heating, its emissions are about 10% of those that you would get from kerosene. So it's a really important step on the way to decarbonizing home heating.
Okay, so it is, for want of a better way of putting it, recycled oil from the fast food industry or as part of that. Okay. And the reason that we're talking about it on the program is because it's an option for people who have who currently heat their home using what would locally be called oil. You know, I know it's technically kerosene, but we call it oil. And many people, you know, every 6 months or so, you have to, as you say, you get the tanker out and they fill it up and all of that. And they already have the infrastructure in their homes. I grew up in one of those homes. That house is still heated by oil. We only got the oil delivered the other day, in fact. So this is an option for people like my family. What is the difference in terms of how we do this or the heat that we might experience? Like, you know, is this a major infrastructural change? Because I know, and the reason I ask the question is because I know for a lot of people, they might have an interest in maybe doing a retrofit in their home to make it more environmentally friendly and to maybe do more insulation and all that, but might not have the budget, say, for a new air to water heating system.
And that's the point. Look, we're not saying that this is an alternative to Deep retrofitting your homes, it's not an alternative to improving the energy efficiency of your homes. It's not even an alternative to heat pumps. If you have a very highly energy efficient home, in my personal opinion, you would be daft not to put a heat pump in. Okay, so it's not saying that we don't need to do all of those things. We're fully in support of all of the government targets to deep retrofit and to put heat pumps in. What we're saying is that even if we meet all of those targets in 2030, there will still be hundreds of thousands of homes in Ireland, and let's be frank, most of them are going to be in rural Ireland, that are still relying on liquid fuel for their heating. And they are also going to be those homes which are probably the most difficult and most expensive to do those retrofits on. So you're right. Everybody wants to do the right thing. We saw research only this week that shows that people are aware that they need to make positive changes to tackle the climate emergency that we're facing. Nobody's denying that, okay? But what we are saying is we can't afford to wait until people have the money to do those deep retrofits and put the heat pumps in. And as a country, we have enough people to actually do the work. That's another part of the challenge, which is sometimes missed. We don't have the workforce to do the work that needs to be done. So I'm saying we talk about a just transition all the time. I think this is a transitionary measure, that this use of HVO is certainly HVO is not the fuel that we think we're going to be using in 10 years' time. Okay, but it is available now. It is something that can make a real difference. So that's a bit of a long preamble to really answering your core question, Aisling, which was, what difference does it make to your family home that had the delivery the other day?
I'm just thinking, like, if I'm used to a certain level of heat in my home, if I swapped from kerosene to HVO, would there be any difference in that experience?
Absolutely zero. It will be exactly the same. More importantly than that, or as importantly, because I know we need to make sure we're warm, but as importantly to that, if you have a modern boiler, anything that's less than 5 to 8 years old, certainly anything less than 5 years old, you will not need to change anything on the boiler. You can, the same truck that delivered the fuel to your family home the other day will arrive with the same person driving it, the same hoses, put it into the same tank. It is a drop-in fuel. You don't need to drain your tank first. You don't need to do anything. You can drop this in on top of the home heating oil that's already there, and it will just cycle through, just work perfectly. If you have a slightly older boiler, you may need to look at compatibility. You may need to look at the jets within the boiler. It's a small thing, and it might require a little bit of fettling of the boiler, perhaps a bill of 150 or 200 quid from the local plumber, not a very complex piece of work at all. If you have a much older boiler, and this is actually a quite important point, you really need to be thinking about replacing that anyway.
Yeah.
Because if you have a non-condensing boiler, if you replace that with a condensing boiler, you will cut the amount of fuel that you use by about 25% overnight. So your fuel bills will reduce by 25% instantly. Also, your emissions will come down by even more than 25% because that boiler is more efficient and it's cleaner. So your fuel bills will drop by about 25%. Your emissions will drop by over 30%. Everybody wins. Now, clearly, there is a cost in replacing that boiler. We think that the SEAI and government should actually offer some support for that. They don't currently. They're only interested in that very, very high level of work that is required to get a house heat pump ready. We're saying that you really need to help people who have those old, inefficient boilers, give them a break, give them some help replacing that. They can reduce their fuel costs going forward, and also reduce the emissions. So they and we all win through that.
What about then maintenance going forward? Like, is it a clean fuel? Will it impact how frequently that you need to get your boiler service? And we should say you should be getting somebody out to service, whether it's an oil or a gas boiler, every 12 months for safety purposes.
Yes, you're right, for safety purposes, Aisling, but also for economic purposes, because you want to make sure that your boiler is working as efficiently as possible. So that service also improves the efficiency of the or ensures the efficiency of the boiler. So yes, that does need to be done every year, but that is not increased by HVO or any other advanced synthetic or biofuels. The fuel is, as far as the boiler concerned, absolutely identical. It makes no difference. It doesn't change the characteristics of the burn in any way. So it doesn't increase the maintenance regime. It's a drop-in fuel available more and more widely. I'll be honest and say it costs a bit more money at the moment.
Yeah.
And that is a challenge. So if you're saying to people, listen, if you want to have that impact of reducing your emissions from your heating system, if you want to drop them by 90%, it's actually going to cost you probably, on average last year, it was about 60% more than kerosene. And that's a lot. And we know the price of the cost of living challenges that people have. But when you compare that to the cost of a deep retrofit, which is over 60,000 now on average, and you get a third of that as a grant. So that means that for, you know, I think from what you're saying, your family story and mine might be very similar. I think of my granny's house in North Cork, and the cost of deep retrofitting that would be, it would be way beyond the average. But there isn't 40 grand sitting around waiting to do that deep retrofit. But there may be, it may be possible to spend an extra 300 or 400 quid a year on having a fuel that's much more responsible and much more sustainable. And some people are making that choice.
Well, Kevin McPartland of Fuels for Ireland, I'm going to ask you to pause there and stay with us. And we're going to take a short break, but we will be back with Kevin to discuss HVO and as an option, because we do like to give you all the options here on Let's Go Green. So stay tuned and we'll be back after these.
Let's Go Green, sponsored by Airgrid, managing and operating Ireland's electricity grid for a cleaner energy future. Check out airgrid.ie for more.
You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. And I'm joined this week by Kevin McPartland of Fuels for Ireland. And Kevin and I have been discussing HVO as an alternative to kerosene or oil for our traditional way of heating our homes. Now, before the break there, Kevin, you did spill the beans on the big difference between kerosene and HVO, and that's brass tacks. It's more expensive to use and to get a load or a refill of HVO into your boiler. So then I suppose the obvious question is, why would I bother? If it's going to cost me so much more money to heat my home using HVO, why would I consider using that over kerosene?
Because it reduces the emissions by about 90% or very close to 90%. And we have to recognize that that's the biggest challenge that humanity is facing right now. So if we're going to take that seriously, we know there are no free mitigation measures. We know that we're all going to have to bear a bit of cost here. Now, what I will say is that that's the difference right now, or that was the average difference over a 12-month period. There is no reason why it needs to stay that way. And there are things that can be done to make it easier. So currently, our advanced synthetic and biofuels are taxed in some instances as though they were fossil fuels. So we have all these taxes that are there designed to reduce the use of fossil fuels, and they're being applied to non-fossil fuels. We think that's something that needs to be changed. And we're talking to government about that. To be fair to the Minister of Finance, we've had really good engagement on that. And I think there is going to be a review of the overall taxation policy on advanced synthetic and biofuels and how they are going to be taxed. The other thing that's going to change as things go forward, you know, you obviously have a real interest in this area, and your listeners do by the very dint of the listening to this program. They will all be aware that when EVs first came onto the market, for example, they were incredibly expensive. There was a massive premium that was put on them. And now there's still a little bit of a premium, but it's come down dramatically. The same with heat pumps. Heat pumps have come down in price per unit dramatically over the last few years. We're at a transition phase here of the market as well as the energy transition. And the market is transitioning away from fossil fuels and toward advanced synthetic and biofuels. And that switch is costly from a commercial perspective. So it is more expensive now as the economies of scale take effect, as more and more people are incentivized to get into this business because they now see that this is a profitable thing to do. And it's worth saying, you know, we talked a little bit about the used cooking oil, but that's not the only potential feedstock for advanced synthetic and biofuels. So you can have such things as, so the ethanol, for example, that goes into petrol at the moment is a co-product of grain processing. So it's something that used to be literally burnt off, flared in the grain processing plants, flared off, is now a valuable co-product. That's being used. There are things, there's research involving algae and all sorts of things. So it's not just about used cooking oil. There are other feedstocks that can be used to create HVO and can be used to create other lower carbon liquid fuels. And as this market matures, as more and more people get involved in it, as they see the potential, as Irish farmers see the potential of contributing to these things, that price should, if on the basis of normal economic rules, those prices should come down.
I know, Kevin, that there are some who are involved in the industry, and I'm not for a second saying that it's you or your members or anything like that, but there are those who are have illicit intentions as part of this, and there are some concerns around the origins of what's being labelled as HVO. So as an Irish consumer, how can we be sure that what we're putting into our boilers is safe, but is what it says it is on the tin? We expect to get when we're paying for it.
Yeah, and it's a fair question, because there have been reasonable concerns around the overall global trade of some of the feedstocks that are going into making HVO around the world. So I suspect that there is some validity in this, that there are people who fear that there have been feedstocks that have been mislabeled. They have been described as used cooking oil, but are actually not used cooking oil. And some of them may even have been virgin palm oil. And virgin palm oil is something that we really don't want to get into the fuels market, because that is something which is contributing to deforestation, contributing to a global biodiversity crisis. We certainly don't want to get involved in that. So speaking only for Fuels for Ireland members, they have to comply with what's called RED, the Renewable Energy Directive, and meet the standards for those feedstocks. And we actually go beyond that. We have independent certification of the feedstocks that we use. All of the fuel that comes into Ireland, all the biofuel that comes into Ireland, meets these independent international standards. I still think, and my members still think, that we need to improve that process on a European level to make sure that all of Europe has a robust regime in place and there is good enforcement, so that my guys, who I am 100% comfortable in saying are playing by the rules and not competing with people who are not. We talked, you know, a few minutes ago about the cost difference and how that competition is really important. And we don't want to be competing with people who are not playing by the rules, who are taking shortcuts. So there is change coming down the line. There's what's called the Union Database. The EU has created a fairly mammoth IT structure which will track every drop of feedstock right the way back to its source, and should, if it is implemented correctly, should eliminate this risk of fuel fraud. We're really determined that that happens, because we get no advantage from there being fuel fraud.
Now, playing devil's advocate here, and there will be people listening to this show, and we are blessed with being rather popular with our listeners, and thank you to everybody who tunes in to us each and every week on Midlands 103 FM, and of course Spotify, Apple and the other podcast outlets. But they will say, well, do you know what, like, of course you're trying to sell us HVO, you're in the fuel industry, if we all switch over to heat pumps, your industry will die. You're on the way out anyway, so you're just trying to sell us this to stay in the market that bit longer.
There's a risk if you respond to a point on the basis of who is making it rather than what the point is. And if people, and look, I get the fact that people who are really strongly motivated by environmental concerns will be cynical and will be suspicious and will put us to proof on what we're saying. Completely welcome that. If you think that I'm being dishonest or my members are being dishonest, hold me to account. If you can say that we are saying something that we don't do, hold us to account. You're right. We're commercial organisations. There are 9 companies that are members of Fuels for Ireland, okay? And let's be really blunt about this. They're big businesses. They make a lot of money, okay? They are very commercially focused. So if we were to ignore the moral imperative for our industry to change, And I'll tell you that we're not ignoring that moral imperative. But even if we were to ignore it, if none of the people who work for the fuel companies in Ireland had any concerns for this planet, for their kids and their grandkids' futures, if they had no concern about any of those things, if they were only motivated by the mighty dollar, they would still have to make these changes, because the law of Ireland, the European laws, are requiring us to make these changes. Nobody is going to be in business in 2040, 2045, 2050 or beyond, or even before then perhaps, selling diesel, gasoline and kerosene as their main products. They're going to go bust. So even if we are worse than the people who are most suspicious of us might think, we would be crazy not to be making significant changes. As it happens, those changes, I firmly believe, are necessary for Ireland anyway, because, as we say, Eamon Ryan talks about us having the most ambitious climate targets in the world, okay? We haven't yet hit a target for heat pumps and deep retrofits of Irish homes. I don't imagine Irish people are going to be comfortable being cold in 10 or 15 years' time. So they're going to continue heating their homes whether those heat pumps are in anyway. So we can continue doing what we're doing. We could be the sunset industry that you described and just ride out the last few years of selling kerosene to heat homes. Or we can say, well, actually, no, we want to make a difference. We want to have sustainable businesses, yes, but a sustainable society, a sustainable environment, a sustainable economy where people can continue to heat their homes, where we reduce the emissions as much as we can right now and ultimately get them down to zero, which is the end game. But we need to recognize that there are transitionary steps. I said to you before, I don't think HVO is the answer. HVO is not something which I think we'll be selling in 10 years' time. But I think it's available right now. It can have a dramatic impact right now. It's something which is reliable. It doesn't require the massive investment in retrofitting that is required to put a heat pump in. It doesn't require the disruption to a family home where somebody might have to move out for a couple of months while that work is being... All those challenges that come with deep retrofitting, essential though that is, not saying it's not, it is essential. But this is something which can be done right now while we're waiting for those homes to be deep retrofitted. And I think whether you are suspicious of the fuels industry or not, I think that's a good contribution to make.
Well, Kevin McPartlin, CEO of Fuels for Ireland, thank you so much for joining us on Let's Go Green. We'll be back after the break.
Let's Go Green, sponsored by Airgrid, managing and operating Ireland's electricity grid for a cleaner energy future. Check out airgrid.ie for more.
You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. And we're joined once again by Catherine Casey of the Heritage Council. Catherine, you're very welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Aisling. It's lovely to be here.
Catherine, you are back because the Heritage Council is accepting applications for funding under the Community Heritage Grant Scheme for this year. Now, that's a bit of a mouthful. What exactly is the Community Heritage Grant Scheme?
Yeah, the Heritage Council actually runs quite a few grants, Aisling, so it's probably important to make the distinction. This is the one that most people would be familiar with. It's the one that's probably the most widely used by local community groups. So it's funding for community and voluntary groups for projects to do with anything on their local heritage. That's the built heritage, natural and the cultural heritage. There's a pot there of over 1.5 million. So it's the largest of our grant schemes, and no match funding is needed. People can apply for funding in the range 500 to 25,000. So they can be very small projects up to fairly substantial projects. And it's anything to do with recording, conserving, protecting, making people aware of building pride in your local heritage.
And for purpose of this, because I'm here looking at the announcement that you put out, and like the amount of things that are projects that could be included in this are quite vast. Like you've got a short list here, and I know that's only a selection of interactive maps, videos, virtual exhibitions, podcasts, websites, collections, protecting habitats. Like the options seem endless with this.
They are. And I suppose maybe the best way to sort of help people focus on what the scheme is for is to give a few local examples. So in recent years, in Laois, we have funding for Dunockmore Workhouse. They carried out an accessibility audit, which looked at how accessible their buildings were to people of all different types of mobility and ability, physical ability and mental ability. And after that, then they created a virtual tour of the workhouse, because obviously part of it is upstairs. A lot of it is not accessible to people who have mobility issues. So they got heritage grant funding to create a virtual tour to allow people to access virtually the parts that maybe are difficult to physically access. Abeleek's Bog Project got funding to carry out conservation works and grow their audiences. Portlaoise Tidy Towns in recent years had funding to do conservation works at Old St. Peter's Church. In Westmead, there was funding at Kilbixie Church, which people will be aware of. That was to conserve one of the mausoleums there. So that was a sort of a built heritage project. Likewise, the number one gun battery in Athlone, people will be very familiar with that. An important part of our of the history of the town had fallen into disrepair. And over a good few years there, a local group has been recording it, documenting it, and now they've moved into active restoration work. In Offaly, there was funding in recent years for building up the archives in Tullamore. There was swift conservation projects in Banagher and in Birr, and a biodiversity audit in Forbann. So that shows, I suppose, the breadth of projects that have been undertaken. And the key part of all of them is one, local communities, and two, any part of our heritage.
So then it begs the question, what definition of heritage do you use for something like this?
Well, we're quite broad. The Heritage Council was set up under the 1995 Heritage Act, which actually has a list of heritage, but it doesn't come, it doesn't exactly define heritage, but it includes everything. The definition that I've heard used that I like is everything that we take from the past that we want to bring to the future. So that includes our archaeology, our monuments, our architectural heritage, big houses, small houses like our thatched houses, but also our wildlife, our habitats, things that we have taken from the past that we want to preserve for future generations. So it includes our oral history, folklore, language is a very important part of it, our traditions. I mean, you can say it's so broad in some ways as to be almost meaningless. I mean, it includes, for example, people would say, well, our sporting heritage is very important to us, our food heritage. Now, they're not things that specifically the Heritage Council has a remit over. So we would limit it to the built natural and cultural heritage. That's the area that we're looking at. When people get down to the specifics of their locality, I think they often, they instinctively know what that heritage is. Your local graveyard would be a big one for everyone. It contains a lot of both built natural and also cultural heritage. Mm.
It's a really interesting one, and such an important, as you say, it's one of the biggest funds that the Heritage Council has to offer. So therefore, as members of the public, it's the one that we see and we come into contact with more frequently, even if we're not aware of that fact. So I know that there is an emphasis here that these projects come from the community, that the community yes. gets involved in putting them forward. So how do people get involved in the programme?
Well, there's all the details that they need are on our website. There's an online form for anybody who's applied before. We actually have a new system in place this year. So everyone has to register just this year, even if you've been even if you've participated in the scheme in the past. Our website is heritagecouncil.ie. So they just need to create themselves a username, a password, and then the system will basically talk them through the information that we need. But by and large, what you need what you need is what exactly are you going to do? When are you going to do it? How are you going to do it? How much is it going to cost? How have you arrived at those costs? Do you have, for example, quotes? Do you have support from the members of your community? If you need a little bit of expertise, where are you going to get that? Your local heritage officer and your local authority would be a really good place to start for that. In fact, we do ask that people consult with their heritage officer and, if possible, get a letter of support from either their heritage or their local biodiversity officer, that the heritage and biodiversity officers would be aware of what they're doing, are prepared to support them. And that's definitely something that people should do as soon as possible. The closing date is at the end of March, the 25th of March. And then what people will be letting people know about funding in May of this year, but they need to be finished those projects by the end of November. So it's quite a tight time frame. But now is the time to start gathering all that information. And I would say the well-planned projects that I see have a clear timeline, they have a clear budget, and they know exactly what they're going to do and who they need to help with. So all of that information needs to be clear in your head before you ever go near a computer really at all.
And of course, every local authority has a heritage and biodiversity officer. And they are the people, if you're thinking of, if you're involved in a community group and you want to get put an application like this together, make an appointment to go and sit down with that person so that they can, so that you can work together and see if it is viable. And even like to get the application correct so that you're putting your thoughts forward clearly and succinctly through the application process, because I know that in itself can be a bit daunting as well, can't it?
It can, absolutely. And there's a technique with a lot of these things. You know, you need to know what exactly is behind the question that's being asked. Just to say, the heritage officer, there is one in every local authority. There's not quite one in every local authority for the biodiversity officers yet, but we're getting there. But definitely your local heritage officer is the best place to start. Sometimes people are nervous of the online element of it. That's no problem. Your heritage officer will help you with that, will help to go through the registration process. But what you could be doing before you contact them is gathering a clear idea of what it is exactly that you want to do and roughly what you think it's going to cost, because there are things that really that you only can do yourself, and who all can support you in your local community. The more local involvement and the more involvement from as many groups as possible, the better.
Well, it is absolutely fascinating, Catherine, and the timeline is short. So as we speak, it's a couple of weeks left to the deadline. So it is important now that if this is something that if you're hearing about this for the very first time, you really need to get yourself in gear and get talking to the groups that you're involved in and get going with this before the end of the month. As Catherine said there, the deadline is the 25th of March with the projects to be completed by the end of November. Catherine, just remind us, where can people go to find out more?
So our website, the Heritage Council, is www.heritagecouncil.ie. You can follow the links there through for funding. You'll get to the online registration page. Also, you'll find the contact details for your local heritage officer on that website as well. So heritagecouncil.ie has all the information that you need.
Well, Catherine Casey of the Heritage Council, thank you very much for joining us once again on Let's Go Green. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks so much, Aisling.
We'll be back after the break.
Let's Go Green, sponsored by Airgrid, managing and operating Ireland's electricity grid for a cleaner energy future. Check out airgrid.ie for more.
You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, and I hope you're enjoying our show so far this week. Well, when I started this show, I have to be honest, the next topic did not enter my head. In fact, until I met my next guest, it hadn't even occurred to me as an environmental concern. We're joined now by Siobhan Dunphy, and Siobhan is the founder of Bon and Berg. And Bon and Berg is a sustainable lingerie brand. Siobhan, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Lovely to be here.
Now, look, we all put on underwear every single day of the week. It's so routine, we probably don't put much thought into it. But I genuinely, and I'm very aware of fast fashion and the problem that it is, but it had not occurred to me that lingerie was part of that. How did you come about founding a company?
Yeah, so that's actually one of the first questions I always get asked is how I started making lingerie, because I'm actually have an engineering background. So nothing to do with fashion or underwear. But for me, it was after I left academia, I started working as a science writer and reading all about climate change and becoming more concerned about my own kind of impacts and how these everyday choices were having on the environment.
Yeah.
And that
okay.
was everything. Yeah. From everything from the food I was eating to the clothing I was wearing, and fast fashion in particular is quite damaging, as we all are aware of these days. And so I thought, what can I do to make a difference? And I found there weren't a lot of options out there for clothing and particularly for underwear. So for me, I thought, if I want to do something and make a difference, why not start with the very first thing you put on in the morning and the very first thing you think about, which will allow you to think about, okay, I'm making a better choice. And you're starting off the day on a more sustainable note, I suppose.
I love my style. I was raised by a gaggle of women who love their style. And it's something I have big guilt over. And I do try to buy from ethical brands. But frequently, that can be a challenge, because I know, like, you have some, and I heard you speak a couple of weeks back, and like fast fashion, I know we know it's a bad thing, but I don't know that we all know the scale of the impact of fast fashion. So take us through just how bad is it for the environment?
So it's quite bad. There's no way of sugarcoating it, really. So there are some statistics out there. They're not exact, and that's mainly due to the fact that the industry is so huge and so global, and it's also very opaque. But just looking at some of the estimates that are out there, I can tell you that according to the UN, the equivalent of one garbage truck full of clothes is burned or dumped into landfill every second. Around 60% of all materials used in the fashion industry are actually made from plastic. So that includes everything from polyester. A lot of people don't realize it's actually plastic. It's the petroleum-based material. Another interesting one is that according to the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, around 500,000 tons of microplastics are released into the ocean each year from washing those clothes. And that's the equivalent of around 50 million plastic bottles. So, yeah, and a couple of other ones. The fashion industry is the second largest consumer of the world's water supply, and it's also responsible for around 4 to 10% of overall carbon emissions, which might not sound, 4 to 10% might not sound like a lot, but if you put it into context, 10% would be more than all of international flights and maritime shipping combined, which we all know are huge polluters.
And, you know, that's the one, when I heard you speak the other week, that's the one that stuck in my head, you know, because I think we have this idea in our minds that the aviation industry, you know, is the bad guy in all of this. Now, I know they're not great, okay, and I'm not saying that they are, but like we live on an island and we have to get a ferry or a plane to go elsewhere. And, you know, it's good that we are exposed to other cultures, other nationalities, other parts of the world. So we do have to balance that, you know, the consciousness around climate change and the environment and then being international citizens. But this idea that the fast fashion industry is actually worse than the aviation industry, it kind of blew my mind.
Mm-hmm. It's quite frightening. And, you know, I'm not saying that nobody should do anything or go anywhere or do anything or, you know, drop everything they love. Like, you know, as you said, you love fashion, but you can still do these things. I think it's just being more aware of the impact they have and then making those small changes every day that you can. So thinking about, okay, where do I get my underwear? You know, can I buy this secondhand? Can I do this? And these have much bigger impacts than you would even imagine, than even, say, taking a flight once a year.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Okay. So let's come back then to Bonn and Berg. And, you know, as you say, you know, we all put underwear on every day. We kind of have to, you know. So how did you decide then that this was going to be what you were going to do to make a change, to have an impact on the world?
I suppose you just said it right there. It's something we put on every day. So, you know, we can shop secondhand for clothing, for almost everything you can find. But with underwear, it's a little trickier. So for me, it was something that you need to have, you want to have, you want it to be nice. But how can we make that more sustainable? So how can that one essential item that we use every day, how can we make that better? And that for me was a big one.
Okay. Right. Okay. So talk to me then about your lingerie. It's not something, as somebody, you know, who enjoys going lingerie shopping on occasion when I have the budget to do so, it's not something I've even seen on the tags. You know, like sometimes you go into clothing stores now and you will see, you know, this jumper is made from recycled polyester, you know, or it's from ethical cotton sources. You know, you'll see some kind of labeling to encourage us to go, oh, well, okay, that's not really fast fashion. That's recycled, and feel a bit better about it. But I haven't noticed that in lingerie stores. So are you one of the first to do something like this?
I would say definitely the first in Ireland, but I'm not the first. There are quite a few out there. But there's not a huge scale of it. So there's a few companies that would do kind of the lacier styles and this kind of thing made from recycled materials, for example. There's a lot of sustainable options made from, say, bamboo or organic cotton. but you have to search for them. So they're not obvious and they're hard to find. So for me, I want this to be something that's more widespread, that everybody knows about and that everyone chooses to buy. So it's quite interesting that you say that you're not seeing it and you don't know about it, which is exactly the problem, is that the things that we need, we can't find more sustainable options for them.
And talk to me then about your products. I'm fascinated. Your fabric is made from beech trees?
Yes. Yes.
How? how do we turn a beautiful beech tree into clothing?
So basically they take the trees, process them into little wood chips. Those chips are then dissolved, and then they're then pushed through kind of a filter type thing called a spinneret. And that creates these very, very fine fibers. And those are then spun into this super soft material that we get. And it's quite amazing, really. And because those fibers are so fine, that's what makes the material so soft and so luxurious. So it almost has a silk-like feel to it.
Okay. Right. Okay. And I know inclusivity is something that's very important to you as well. And like, it's something that it can be very challenging for companies, particularly I'm thinking of skin tones, and nudes used to be white. But obviously we know that skin comes in all colors. So you have avoided that so far. There are no nudes at Bonnenberg yet, at least.
Yeah, that was something at the start. And it's something I often get asked at, why don't you do a nude color or a skin tone color? And it's because it's very difficult to do a skin tone color because there are so many different skin colors. And as a sustainable startup company, we're quite small. We keep our production quite small, and that is how we stay more sustainable. So if I did want to go and branch out and do a nude color, for me, I would have to include every skin tone. So that would be a lot of knickers. So instead, I've just opted to come out with different colors, which I think are quite nice, and have thus far avoided the nudes.
And I can understand that. And I think it's a great philosophy to have. So these beech trees that are used in the production of the material for your products, how do you then make sure, because we're, you know, the messaging is about planting more trees, you have to cut them down to make the fabric. So how do you balance that out?
Yeah, that's one thing I was also concerned with at the start. So that is a big issue. And that's what's happening with a lot of these, you know, tree-based raw materials, like, for example, bamboo. Then you end up, it becomes a cash crop and it starts getting planted as a monoculture and forests start getting raised. So that's not what we want. Obviously, we want to keep it sustainable. So that's why I ensure that all the materials we get are certified by Lenzing, which is an Austrian brand. And that ensures that the trees are responsibly sourced. So they're FSC certified, and all of the process is closed loop. So nothing that's used within the dyeing or the any of the production process is released into the environment. That's all reused. So it limits the environmental damage. But the only way you can be sure of that is by ensuring that the material is certified.
Well, Siobhan Dunphy of Bonnenberg, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. And if listeners are interested in finding out more about you and about Bonnenberg, where's the best place to go?
So you can follow us on Instagram at Bonnenberg, and you can also check out our website, www.bonnenberg.com.
Thank you so much for joining us on Let's Go Green. And I tell you, Siobhan, I genuinely had never anticipated discussing lingerie on the radio, but here we are, and it's a fascinating topic. So best of luck with your endeavor.
Thanks so much. It's been great.
Well, I'm afraid that is all we have time for on this week's episode of Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103 with me, Aisling O'Rourke. As always, a big thank you to all my guests on this week's show and to you for listening. And remember that if you've missed an episode of Let's Go Green, you can hop over to midlands103.com, look on the podcast page and listen to all our back catalogue of episodes. All our shows are also available on Apple and Spotify podcasts. And in fact, I'd really appreciate it if you could hop over to your preferred podcast app and hit that follow button. It actually really does help in spreading the word about Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103. I hope you have a fabulous week. Remember, you can always suggest an item for the show. If you'd like to appear on the show, just go over to Let's Go Green on the Midlands103.com website. Send me a message directly from the Let's Go Green page and I will be sure to check it out. Have a great week. Stay safe. We won't be here next week because we all get a long weekend because of St. Patrick's Day. So I'll be back in a fortnight's time. Stay safe.
Let's Go Green, sponsored by Airgrid, managing and operating Ireland's electricity grid for a cleaner energy future. Check out airgrid.ie for more.